Magandang araw, Podmates! Howie Severino muli na nagpapaalala na nakakatalino ang mahabang attention span. Ang guest natin ngayon ay ang isa sa pinakamalakas na boses na nagtatanggol ng ating teritoryo sa West Philippine Sea na inaangkin ng China. Ang former Supreme Court Associate Justice Antonio Carpio. Magandang araw sa inyo, Justice Carpio. Thank you for joining us.
Magandang araw, Howie. Magandang araw sa ating mga viewers.
Sir, you know, even before you retired as Supreme Court Justice, you had made the defense of our maritime territory against China one of your chief causes, if not your main one, no? Why did you decide to devote a large part of your time, resources, and thinking to this issue? And corollary to that, sir, was there a tipping point for you when you decided, you know, I need to spend much or most of my time on this?
Yeah, well, it goes back to 1995 and early 1996 when China seized Mischief Reef. I was then with President Fidel Villaramos as his chief presidential legal counsel in Malacanang. And we were really like a headless chicken at the time because we couldn't do anything. We didn't know what to do. We already ratified UNCLOS at the time, but China had not ratified the UNCLOS, so we could not sue China before an UNCLOS tribunal. And the U.S. had just left. We kicked them out in 1992. So there was a power vacuum in the South China Sea. Of course, if there's a power vacuum, the next power will come in, will rush in, and China rushed in and seized Mischief Reef. And we didn't know how to respond because, militarily, we were much weaker. And legally, there was no avenue, there was no tribunal where we could go. And that really struck a deep chord in my mind because we were losing our maritime zone and yet we couldn't do anything. And so ever since, I've tried to think about it and to think how we can defend ourselves in the future against Chinese expansion, because I knew it was not the last seizure of our maritime zone by China. In the time, they would seize more of our maritime zones. I had the opportunity when the new baselines law was brought to the Supreme Court. It was challenged. The constitutionally was challenged by some professors, including Harry Roque, and I decided that case, and I saw there that we could defend legally our maritime zones by going to UNCLOS, but we had to first comply with the requirements of UNCLOS as to our baselines, because if we go to an UNCLOS tribunal and challenge China's illegal baselines, the nine dash line, China will say, oh, you have also your illegal baselines. You have also you're treating the Treaty of Paris lines as your baselines. So we had to put our house in order before we could bring a case against China because of the principle in international law that he who comes to court must come with clean hands. I mean, if you go to court, you cannot accuse somebody of an illegal act which you yourself is guilty of. So that's also a principle in domestic law. So I thought that if we become compliant with UNCLOS, then we could bring China to an UNCLOS tribunal. That's how it started.
Okay, so you said that your keen interest began in 1995, you know, with the Chinese occupation of Mischief Reef. That's almost 20 years ago, no? And you have said that this is an intergenerational struggle that future generations will inherit, no? So it's not going to end soon, no? So you've been devoted to this cause for almost 20 years, but you say this is going to stretch far into the future. On the other hand, some have also said that China can really make this quick and dirty with a short, sharp war that would basically and our opposition. No, what do you think of that scenario? Kumbaga, it might actually end with this generation. Isn't there a great risk now of a sudden escalation that would permanently drive us out of these disputed territories?
Well, the last thing that China would want to do is to give the U.S. an opportunity to intervene by engaging an armed attack on the Philippines or on Philippine public vessels. No? Because then we could invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty, and then China will be confronted not with a weak military power like the Philippines, but with a nuclear armed power, which has, China has about 450 nuclear bombs. The U.S. has about 5,500. In a nuclear war, not a single Chinese would remain alive in mainland. They would be totally destroyed. So there is this doctrine of China, the three warfares doctrine, which they have approved. Now, all the way from the People's Congress to the Politburo to the Military Commission. Basically, it says that China will win the South China Sea without firing a single shot. They will win the South China Sea without firing a single shot. First warfare is a PR warfare. So China is saying they own the South China Sea since 2,000 years ago. We have blunted that warfare because we have exposed that the nine dash line is a fake, claim that was ruled upon by the tribunal at The Hague, that there's no historical basis for the nine dash line. Second warfare of China is illegal warfare. China is saying that they are exempt from UNCLOS because the nine dash line stretches back to 2,000 years ago, but that has been debunked also by the tribunal. The third warfare of China is they will intimidate all the other claimant states with their huge air and naval bases in the Spratlys, with their huge naval fleet. They have the largest naval fleet in the world, with their numerous fighter jets and bombers, and by their huge Coast Guard, the largest Coast Guard in the world. So they will intimidate everybody. And if you are dumb enough to be intimidated, you lose. Like Duterte, he said, we cannot fight China because it will be a massacre. I mean, if you have that mindset, then you lose, because under the three warfare strategy of China, that's precisely what they want, to intimidate you. And if you get intimidated, you lose. So in all these three warfares of China, they avoid at all cost a war, a shooting war, because a small skirmish, if it's an armed skirmish, it would escalate into a nuclear war, especially if the Philippines is involved, because we have a mutual defense treaty. So all that China is doing is to intimidate us by their huge air and naval bases, by their water cannon, but they will not use an armed attack because that will draw the Americans in. And if the Americans are in, then they're in a great peril, because they, as of this time, they are still no match to the Americans. So that's why they are doing an intimidation, just to intimidate us. So we should understand the three warfare strategy of China.
So you sound quite confident in the U.S. commitment to our defense as a deterrent, no, to an all-out war by China, no. But so far, no, are you satisfied with the U.S. response to what China has been doing? Because China has not exactly been passive, no. Yung nabanggit nyo yung pagwa-water cannon, no. I mean, from there, it's fairly easy to imagine some accidental gunshot that will spiral out of control. And wars have started that way, diba? With a single gunshot. World War I started that way, diba? Do you think that the U.S. will really come to our defense?
Well, a single gunshot will not really start a war, because there is a principle of proportionality. You can invoke self-defense if you are subjected to armed attack, but there is a principle of reciprocity. If there's only one single gunshot, then you cannot really use all your cruise missiles, all your torpedoes. I mean, it should be proportional. There is that proportionality. That's precisely to avoid any accidental war. You must exercise proportionality in your response. So it has to be a real armed attack. I mean, intentional. Those small skirmishes arising from accidents that can be resolved by being circumspect about your response, because there is the principle of proportionality under international law. Let's say the Chinese will say, okay, one option is for us to attack the Philippine Navy in Ayungin Shoal or in Scarborough Shoal. So then the Philippines will invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty. What will be the response of the U.S.? First, if the U.S. responds by attacking us also, then that would be against their three warfare strategy. They don't want a war with the U.S. So that's a no-no for them if the U.S. responds. Now, if the U.S. does not honor the treaty, the U.S. says, we will not honor the treaty, then what will happen? Then what will happen is that Japan, Korea will start to doubt the U.S. commitment. And Japan and Korea will be forced to go nuclear. There will be a great debate in Japan. In Korea, it's an easy decision because an overwhelming majority of South Koreans now want to go nuclear already. So what will happen is that China will be surrounded by nations that are hostile but with nuclear weapons. You have Russia, you have if South Korea will turn nuclear, you have Japan, and you have Australia will go nuclear for sure if the U.S. Will not honor its commitment, because Australia will have to defend itself. So you have all countries, you have India also, nuclear arms. So China will be surrounded on all sides by nuclear armed states that are hostile to China. So it is in the interest, national interest of China not to force the U.S. to give up the nuclear umbrella, because then all these nations will go nuclear, and that will be a worse nightmare for China. So if I'm the strategist in Beijing, I'm looking at it, I will not do anything that will make the U.S. decide whether to honor the treaty or not, because either way, it will be bad for China. So if you look at it that way, all those protected by that nuclear umbrella will go nuclear, because that is an existentialist threat. That's a matter of existence, national survival for them. So that's why for the Chinese, they want to control the South China Sea without firing a single shot, because that's easier for them.
Well, so far, no, we've filed more than 100 diplomatic protests against China because of their actions in the West Philippine Sea. For those of our listeners who are not very aware of the implications of this kind of protest, ano po yung diplomatic protest, and how can this be effective?
Well, first of all, it is a must that a country must file a diplomatic protest. Because if your sovereignty is infringed, if your maritime zones are infringed, and you do not act, you do not say anything, then that can be taken as acquiescence, implied consent. And if that issue goes to an UNCLOS tribunal, the tribunal will say, oh, you acquiesced, you impliedly consented, you cannot complain now. And that's what exactly raised in The Hague. In our arbitration, one of the issues raised was, did we acquiesce to the 9-dash line? And we presented all our protests, all our notes verbal ever since, hundreds of them way back in the 90s. And the tribunal said, no, there are sufficient protests made by the Philippines way back in the 90s. And that is the importance of a note verbal, because we we stop ourselves from being trapped in that principle that if you do not protest to an infringement on your sovereignty or sovereign rights, you are deemed to have impliedly consented. Okay, so there's a value in itself to protest. We must keep on protesting. Beyond that, we have to do something. Like, for example, we must have joint patrols with the U.S. Because a joint patrol in the West Philippine Sea, for me, is the strongest action that we can take to enforce the arbitral award. Because if the Philippines and the U.S. conduct a joint patrol, both of them are telling China that these are not your waters. This belongs to the Philippines. It's part of the exclusive economic zone of the Philippines. That's why we can conduct naval drills there. Because in the exclusive economic zone under UNCLOS, countries conduct naval drills. And China said, you cannot conduct naval drills because that's within the nine-dash line. But we do that. And the more we do that, the more we enforce the arbitral award.
Well, despite these alliances and, you know, our victory in the international tribunal, no, for the last several years, China has been building all kinds of infrastructure already, you know, in the disputed areas and reefs as if they own it, no, from runways and bases, outposts. And there's a growing population of Chinese people based there, assigned there. Is there a scenario where we can still reclaim those areas and occupy them for ourselves and the Chinese will leave? What's the best scenario for us?
Well, first of all, I've been saying this since late last year that we should challenge China to submit the territorial dispute, because we're talking now of the territorial dispute. The maritime dispute has been settled legally. We have a full exclusive economic zone in the West Philippine Sea. But the territorial dispute was not part of the ruling of the UNCLOS Tribunal, because UNCLOS does not regulate territorial disputes. There is no convention or treaty regulating territorial disputes. So China and the Philippines and the rest of the claimant states must submit voluntarily the territorial dispute to voluntary arbitration by the International Court of Justice, but that has not happened yet. I am now asking the government to challenge China to submit the territorial dispute to voluntary arbitration. We challenge China, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei to submit the territorial dispute to voluntary arbitration, because the UN Charter says all disputes must be settled peacefully by negotiation, mediation, or finally by arbitration. And we are just following the UN Charter. So we should challenge China. If China does not agree, then we will present all our evidence before the world. We will tell the world that these are the evidences of the Philippines on why we have sovereignty over these disputed islands, these territories. Because then if we cannot go to the International Court of Justice, then we could go to the Court of World Opinion. Because that's the only thing we can do to get the world on our side. And we have the ironclad evidence that we have a better right than anybody. China, Vietnam, Malaysia, and all the other countries, we have the best title. We have the best claim because we follow international law. There's so many principles of international law we can use to say that we have the strongest claim. That's why we should challenge everybody to submit the territorial dispute to voluntary arbitration. Well, that's on the legal side. On the practical side, we should not give up our claim, because sea level rise by the end of the century will be 1 to 2 meters and even higher than that beyond the century. And that will submerge all the islands in the spread list. And once submerged, they will form part of our exclusive economic zone if within 200 nautical miles. So all we have to do is to hang on to our claim. Never give up our claim, because everything will be underwater in that area by by the end of the century and beyond because of sea level rise.
Okay, Justice, you mentioned the need to court public opinion, world opinion. Many have noticed that the Philippine government has actually been more assertive lately in terms of courting that opinion. The Coast Guard, the Navy have been sharing a video of what's going on there in the maritime world, the harassment by Chinese vessels, bringing the media, foreign journalists to these areas, etc. What else can the government do? And ano ba yung options ngayon ng Marcos administration?
Well, we the template is there. We follow what Malaysia and Indonesia did. Malaysia depends on oil and gas exports to fuel its economy, and their reserves have gone down, so they decided to open new wells. They send their drill and survey ship to their exclusive economic zone, but within the nine-dash line, the China said, you cannot do that. That's within the nine-dash line. There will be war. But they still proceeded. They sent their survey and drill ship, and accompanied by their Navy and Coast Guard. And at the same time, the U.S. and Australia conducted naval drills in the same area. So the Chinese Coast Guard couldn't do anything. So the Malaysians were successful. And that's why Anwar Ibrahim said recently, we don't have a problem with China on the South China Sea because they are getting the gas. Even if China does not recognize their exclusive economic zone, as long as they are getting the oil and gas, they are winning. Because at bottom, the exclusive economic zone is about how you can exploit the natural resources in the exclusive economic zone. So Malaysia is happy because they are getting the oil and gas despite the threats of China. Indonesia did the same. Indonesia wanted to survey and drill in the Natunas, but it fell within the nine-dash line of China. And China said, you cannot do that. There will be war. Indonesia sent its survey and drill ship to the Natunas, accompanied by its Navy. At the same time, the U.S. sent its aircraft carrier, the Ronald Reagan, in the same area. So the Chinese couldn't do anything. So Indonesia completed its survey and drilling. We should do the same in Reed Bank because the template is there. Mm-hmm. And we have a mutual defense treaty with the U.S. And the U.S. said, yes, we're happy to accompany you to Reed Bank. So it requires only political will. During the time of Duterte, of course, he said, no, he intimidated us on behalf of China that there will be massacre if we do that. And so we did not send our survey and drill ship. But Malaysia did, Indonesia did, and they succeeded. So we just have to follow that. There's the template already on how to get your gas. It doesn't matter that China doesn't recognize our EEZ, because at bottom, the EEZ about the use of the natural resources, the oil and gas. If we can get the oil and gas, even if China doesn't agree, then we're winning. That's it.
So, Justice, you've also suggested building civilian structures such as lighthouses or a research center so that we can file a complaint to UNCLOS in case China shows aggression again. No, explain to us the logic of that. Because what's going on are military activities and not civilian. Therefore, they're not covered by UNCLOS. Tama ba yon, Justice?
Yes, that's correct. When we filed the arbitration against China in 2012, we included that. We asked the tribunal to direct China to stop harassing us every time we send a resupply to BRP Sierra Madre. And the tribunal said, we cannot order China to stop harassing you because that's a military activity. And military activity are excluded because China in the reservation, and that's allowed, said that we will not be subjected to compulsory arbitration on matters involving military activities and on matters involving overlapping exclusive economic zones. So that's allowed. So the tribunal refused to order China to stop the harassing us whenever we resupply Sierra Madre. So what we should do is to put up a civilian structure. like a lighthouse operated by the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is civilian, so that if China stops us from building that structure, lighthouse, or stop us from resupplying that lighthouse with a Marine Research Center, we can go to the tribunal and pile up these judgments against China. So that's the way out of that dilemma, that we are being harassed by China, but there is no tribunal to go to.
Okay. Why is China so intent on expanding their territory at other nations' expense and at the expense of China's own reputation? Ano ba yung over, ano ba yung big picture dito, Justice? I mean, China is also risking a lot, no, by doing all of this, no? Parang they are offending us, threatening many other countries. They feel threatened by China's actions. Bakit ba ginagawa ito ng China in the first place?
Well, because the present leadership in China are imperialistic. They said they will recover everything that China lost during the century of humiliation. But they never possessed the South China Sea. Because if you look at all the ancient maps of China, throughout the Chinese dynasties, their southernmost territory in the South China Sea was Hainan. It never went further south than Hainan. They're using their historical claim, but their historical claim in the South China Sea is totally false. But why do they do this? Because they are acting as an imperialist power. They want to control the South China Sea, to own it as their national territory, which is against international law, against UNCLOS, against history. I mean, no country can now claim an entire sea. That's just out of this world. That's outlandish, absurd. But China still says, oh, we owned the South China Sea since 2,000 years ago. Nobody believes that. That has been debunked by the tribunal. There's no evidence, historical evidence of that. But why is China doing this? Because Chinese leaders are greedy. They want to get all the natural resources in the South China Sea for themselves. It's out of greed. Imperialism is the manifestation of greed, national greed. And it's because of this greed by the national, by the Chinese leaders. They want to deprive everybody else. They want to get it. But they're getting, let's say in the South China Sea, you have high seas. The high seas belong to the global commons. It belongs to all mankind. It belongs to Nepal, belongs to Switzerland, landlocked countries. But they still ignore that. They want to get the high seas, which belongs to all mankind. So you have to have that frame of mind where you totally disregard the legal order, international legal order. You disregard all kinds of morality. You disregard the common good because you just want everything for yourself. That's greed. That's the manifestation that is what is driving imperialism. And that is in the DNA of the present leaders of China.
But isn't there also somewhere a genuine fear of America? Because America is knocking on their door, basically, by having a presence in their part of the world. Wala naman Chinese Navy na umiikot sa California siguro or sa New York, no? Hindi tulad ng American Navy with nuclear weapons moving around China. If a country as large as China that has had a colonial history as well, and having been occupied and, you know, conquered by foreign powers, I mean, isn't that part of their calculation? You know, aside from desiring, you know, natural resources that belong to others or belong to the international community, hindi ba may perception din sa kanila na, you know, there's a superpower moving around in our neighborhood and we need to protect ourselves from them.
That is why China has offered the U.S. Let's divide the world. It's, the world is too big for both of us. We can divide it. So leave to us the South China Sea. That's ours. And the rest will be yours. So they know that. Of course, the U.S. Would not want to do that because they would be abandoning their traditional allies and they will lose credibility. But that's why I'm saying, who knows, Trump might become the president next time, and he will say, okay, accept, I accept the offer of China, we divide the world. You take care of the, your sphere of influence will be the South China Sea. And that could happen. That's why I'm saying we should prepare for that day. We should now engage our ASEAN neighbors, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, that, you know, at the end of the day, it might be just ourselves trying to defend what's ours here in the South China Sea, because the two superpowers might come to an agreement. And that will just leave us on our own to defend our maritime zone. So let us do it now. Let's conduct naval drills jointly to protect, to fortify our defenses. And that is why I say we have to develop our military capability, because at the end of the day, we only have to rely, we can only rely on ourselves, really. And if you look at history, countries that failed to develop a credible self-defense force were eaten up, were absorbed by their stronger neighbors. And we have to be prepared for that. We cannot rely forever on the U.S. because their policy could change. I mean, they could get tired of defending others. And you may have a Trump there who will just say, okay, let's just divide the world. And there's a danger that he could also be the next president. So we have to prepare for that. I mean, yes, we are allies now, but their national interests could change. That's why it's important we must develop our military defenses. We must have a credible self-defense force, and we're far from that. There is no free lunch in this world. If you don't put up your defenses, you don't fortify your defenses, then you will be erased from the map. That has happened to many countries. And it could happen to us if we don't develop a credible self-defense force.
Okay, Justice Carpio, in a previous era, we challenged China in the international tribunal, and the Philippines won, no? And then the Duterte administration that came after that, after the Aquino administration, which challenged China, reversed course and decided to be friendlier towards China. Yun ang strategy nila. Perhaps thinking that, you know, Philippines will somehow benefit from that kind of stance or policy towards China. But so looking back now, Justice, no? Did the Duterte administration's policy of friendship towards China help the Philippine cause? What did we gain or lose? And how would the situation be different if President Duterte continued the policies of the Aquino administration?
Well, we didn't gain anything. We were taken for a ride by China. China promised us 22 to 24 billion in loans and investments. That never materialized, only less than 3-4% of that materialized. And that's nothing compared to the lost years, 6 years. We didn't do anything. We allowed China to fish in our exclusive economic zone against the express provision of the Constitution. We did not do anything to fortify our claim. We're doing that now. We're having joint patrols with all other countries, with many countries. But that was really a terrible period. I mean, it was a nightmare for us who were trying to defend the country, because you have the president who was just being fooled by China. And it was very obvious that the goal of China is to get the South China Sea within the 9, now 10 dash line. That's very clear. I mean, to any average person, that's very clear. But here is a president who said, oh, China is our friend. I love Xi Jinping. So it was a terrible time, really. It was a terrible time.
Okay, Justice, another issue. I just want to pivot a little bit. No, before we end, I want to ask you your thoughts on the moves to change our constitution. I know you've been speaking out about this as well. No, any your latest thoughts nyo, about this? Is there a need to do this?
Well, first, the reason, ostensible reason that they're saying telling all of us is that we need to change the economic provisions of the Constitution to increase the foreign direct investment. Because without foreign direct investment, the unemployment will remain high. The economic growth will be slow. Okay, let's look at that. We have already opened the economy under the latest amended Public Service Act. No? We opened transportation, airlines, sea transportation, and land transportation, except for PUVs, those individual jeepney drivers. No? We have opened, even before banking, 100% foreign ownership, we have opened retail trade. We require only 10 million per store. That's very low. We have opened power generation for wind, for solar, for tidal, for hydro, for thermal. We have opened practically everything already. There are about four or five items that we have not opened up. But we, as far as our neighbors are concerned, we are there among the most liberalized countries in terms of foreign investments. We have the most liberal foreign investments laws now. But still, our foreign direct investment is low. Why? Because the causes of our low foreign direct investment are, one, high power rate. The foreign nationals come to Asia, ASEAN, to put up plants, to manufacture. Plants use a lot of power, and it can be anywhere from 20 to 60% of your operating cost. So if they locate there, they cannot compete with their competitor or establish a plant in Vietnam or China, whose power rates are very low. So that's really one of the factors of why our FDI is low. Second is that we are too bureaucratic. To open a plant, you have to go to the barangay to get a locational clearance. You have to go to the municipality to get the mayor's permit and all others. You have to go to the executive department that has jurisdiction over you. It could be the Department of Health if you're manufacturing medicine. You have to go to specialized agencies that have also jurisdiction. So compared to Vietnam and China, you just go to one office. You get all your permits there. So in terms of bureaucracy, we're too bureaucratic. I mean, it's a nightmare for foreign investors to get all the permits in the Philippines. The third is that our infrastructure is behind compared to our ASEAN neighbors. You can just go to our airports, and you can see that our airports are not on par with them. Even our internet, quite slow still, although we're improving. And the roads, seaports, we have to improve. We have really to invest to improve our infrastructure. So we have to address the real causes. The Constitution has nothing to do. Because if you go to China, you go to Vietnam, their citizens cannot even own land because the state owns everything. Their citizens can only have 75-year lease, both in China and Vietnam. And in Vietnam or China, foreigners cannot own more than 49% of telecommunications. We allow 100%. We have opened up really our economy. We are more liberal than Vietnam or China, yet they get more FDI. They get more foreign direct investment. So you can see where the problem is. Power cost. We are too bureaucratic. And our infrastructure is lagging behind. So that's why I think there must be something else. Why do they want to change the Constitution when it has nothing to do with the low FDI? Well, I think the answer is there. In their People's Initiative, it's not the economic provisions that are being changed. It's how to vote. They want the voting to change so that only they can propose amendments upon the call of the speaker alone, and the vote of the members of the House alone, even if the entire Senate will be against us, a proposed change, they can totally ignore the Senate. So they're changing the check and balance within Congress, and that is a revision that's not allowed in a people's initiative. So it's very clear. They said that the law FDI is to be blamed on the Constitution, but they're not changing the provision of the Constitution, the economic provision. They're changing the political provision.
Thank you. That's quite clear. I want to wind down now, Justice, by asking you about one of your pet projects while you were in the Supreme Court, the e-library or electronic library of Supreme Court cases. No, I think you began it about 20 years ago, and it more recently became accessible to the public for free. No, why did you start this, and what is its value to the public?
Well, you know, before I joined the Supreme Court, I had on my laptop all the decisions of the Supreme Court from 1901 to the present then, all the laws of the Philippines from 1901 to up to that time. And I had a search engine, and I could just type a letter, a word or a phrase, and I could get all of this instantly. And I said, you know, a judge to be efficient must have this. Because if you don't have that, can you just imagine you have to go through all the decisions? And you need an army of law clerks to do that, and we don't have that. So I said, okay, I will provide this facility to all the judges and all their law clerks. And so I put it up. I put that up. We bought scanners. We scanned all the decisions. So you can find there in the Supreme Court e-library now all decisions of the Supreme Court since 1901, more than a century ago, all the laws of the Philippines from the very beginning, since 1901 up to now, and all the circulars, rules and regulations handed down by the Supreme Court. So it's all there. And all the judges now, all over the country, we are an archipelago. And before, we used to send mimeographs, copies of the decisions. And it was difficult to send these mimeograph copies. They're bulky. And the post office refused to carry them because they said it's not mail, it's cargo. And we had this running problem with the post office. They said, we will not carry that. That's cargo. That's not mail. So, you know, we even came out with a resolution directing them, mandating them to carry it. But the postman, he will just throw away those bulky decisions and will not deliver. And that was our problem. The judges had no copies of our recent decisions. So what we did, because of the internet, we gave them access. And also, we on a quarterly basis, we send them CDs, compact disc of the recent decisions. So the postmen were very happy because they were just carrying the disc instead of a pile of cargo of paper. So that's how all the judges all over the country could instantly get the latest decisions of the Supreme Court. And now we opened that just before I retired. We opened that to the public. So all the law schools, all the law students, they have access to this already. And the public also has access to that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's useful not just for judges, but for any researchers, you know, law students or anyone needing to look up laws and regulations. Yes. of the country, you know. So on that note, we want to thank you, Justice Carpio, for this important service of providing, you know, those documents that, you know, that heritage of laws to the public, but also for shedding all this light about our territorial issues. And thank you for spending this time with us, former Supreme Court Associate Justice Antonio Carpio. Maraming salamat po at mabuhay po kayo.
Thank you, Howie. Thank you to our viewers for listening, for watching. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Howie Severino. Check out the Howie Severino podcast. New episodes will stream every Thursday. Listen for free on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and other platforms.